Good evening. A few weeks ago, somebody asked, how can I improve my discipline? Have you ever heard that question before? It's not the first time I heard it. It's a very common question. They're talking about their practice, of course. How can I improve my discipline? I think the question arises for people when they have some confusion about the practice. So very many people are drawn to the practice or attracted to this practice because they feel some kind of suffering in their life. And they feel some problem about the strictly rational way they have been living their life. So they come to Zen practice seeking a way out of this confusion. But if you look at the history of practice in this country, if you look at the various Zen centers in this place, you see that there's so many people who come and go. Most people do have a problem or have some difficulty staying with the practice once they start. Some people come for a few times or even a few weeks and don't come back, have trouble sticking with the practice. And that's very, very common. That's why in the practice we have sanghas and teachers in various forms that we do to help us slide into the practice in a comfortable way, in a supportive way. So sanghas and various forms encourage each other in our practice when we have some trouble getting a handle on it in the beginning. But the real problem is not so much the confusion or the disorientation or what do I do next kind of question. The real problem comes up when we allow ideas of what's in my best interest to creep in. When we are concerned with what's in my best interest too much, we develop certain expectations of what we hope to obtain from the practice. What will I get? And when we are looking to get something, we will never feel settled down on the cushion. If we are concerned with what am I going to get, we'll feel impatience and a lack of discipline that would enable us to sit quietly. And what's in my best interest is, I think, is one of the downsides of our present culture. But this is the culture we have, so we practice in this culture. And sometimes people will say, well, look, Zen practice is not for everyone. And strictly speaking, this is not true. It's a very rational idea, isn't it? And in Buddhism we say this is dualistic idea, because it says, oh look, there are two kinds of people. Zazen is for this kind of person, and Zazen is not for that kind of person. Two kinds of people. This is a misunderstanding. There are no such thing as two kinds of people. Our practice, as you know, is expression of the original way of life of everyone, not just certain people. Our practice is the expression of our nature, our true nature, everyone's true nature, who we all are. But it requires it requires a selfless effort. In other words, to step into the practice and to understand the practice and to embrace it with our life, we have to put aside, you know, for time, our self-oriented activities, our daily self-oriented activities. We have to put them aside for a time. 20 minutes a day, an hour a day, 3 month training period, 1 day retreat. Put aside for some time activities that we can say, what will I get from it? In other words, the practice is about letting go for a period of time, ideas of comfort and exciting, our own ambitions, our own dreams, activities that we can say, these are in my best interest. We have to put those aside if we want to discover the meaning of this practice. So if somebody comes to the practice and is here for a while and everybody gets to know that person, and then after a few weeks or so that person no longer doesn't come back, somebody may say, well, look, Zen practice is not for everyone. But what it really means is that person is a bit stubborn, or maybe that person has a very busy life, or she has so much energy she can't sit, or he seems pretty happy, he has no need to sit. But we don't say, oh, the practice is only for certain people. Instead, we say, maybe she isn't ready yet. And let it go at that. The understanding that we have in our practice is that people are not inherently self-oriented. Even though we know people and meet people who seem selfish in their ways and very self-oriented, we know that fundamentally, inherently, they're not that way. Even though they may act that way for whatever reason, or whatever has come up in their life. In other words, we trust that everyone wants to understand their true self. And that the notion of what's in my best interest is just a temporary feeling. So we don't dismiss people who seem to have that kind of attitude. We just say, oh, it's temporary. Not quite ready, but the door is always open, and the door of our mind is always open. So So today's world, today's culture, there is much in this economy that emphasizes doing things in our self-interest. There is the promise of affluence all around us. And there's a continual message through the various medias that all of this can be yours. All of this should be yours. You deserve all of it. We're told that over and over. And we get caught up in it. There's the danger of getting caught up in it. This striving for affluence. And if that feeling is strong, the feeling in pursuing what's in our best self-interest, practice, spiritual practice, will seem like a waste of time. But that's a misunderstanding. All of us have come to this practice these days because we began to see that misunderstanding. We are beginning to see that misunderstanding about what the culture says we should be and what we should do. We're beginning to see that there's something else. And we begin to understand that what's in my best interest will not bring us peace of mind. And it will not relieve any personal problems that we have pursuing personal self-interest. When we begin to understand that, and if we say, well, if I don't pursue my personal best interest, what do I do? And we realize there's another way to live our life. And so we seek out the practice. So if we want to encourage our own discipline, we have to trust the practice. In the monastery or in the military, there are some senior people who will push your discipline, push you to have discipline. If you join the Marines, you will learn discipline. If you go to monastic practice in Japan, you will learn discipline. We don't do that. We don't push discipline from, top down, or have somebody else make us disciplined. We want to learn disciplined practice through our own experience, which means we have to trust the practice. And we have to trust ourselves at the deepest level. We have to trust and start to believe that we came to this practice for a very deep reason that cannot be explained. In other words, we have to trust who we are beyond who we think we are. In other words, again, we have to trust our intuitive self. and not emphasize just our rational, objective self. And without this trust in ourself, practice will be confusing and will be disappointing. When that happens, we run the risk of rationalizing our own lack of trust and say to ourselves, oh, this practice isn't for everyone. I can't do this practice because it's not for me. What it really means is, I don't trust myself, but we don't like to see it that way. We say, it's not for me. The founder of the Soto Zen school in China was Tozan, one of the founders. And he had a poem about all this. And his poem is, in the dusk of early evening, before the moon has risen, it is little wonder if you fail to recognize the person you meet. Dimly, dimly, you approach him as a stranger with your habitual suspiciousness. That's a brilliant poet. This habitual suspiciousness that he talks about is really not trusting ourselves. It means we are still relying only on our rational capacity, our thinking mind. And we become so attached to our rational way of thinking, we come to believe that that's our true nature. And this, of course, is a big misunderstanding. In his poem, when he says, before the moon has risen, he means the moon of understanding has not yet risen. Has not yet risen to cast some light. And that's why we remain a dim stranger to ourselves. So, if we have some determination and some discipline, just start with some, then in the midst of doubts and uncertainty, we will continue our practice. And little by little, learn to let go of the thinking and rational activity of our mind. And in its place, we will be encouraging our intuitive capacity. And we will learn to trust this perceptive capacity. And little by little, find some encouragement from our effort. And then we will have a new feeling about our practice. And Tozan had another poem about this confidence. He says, the dawn has come to the surprise of an old woman, and she chances upon an antique mirror in which she sees clearly and distinctly her own face, so different from all the images she had formed of herself. From now on, she will no longer ignore her own head and grasp at its mere shadows. This imagery is remarkable. And when that happens, when we no longer grasp at our own head and the shadows it casts, it means we are beginning to understand our true self. And that we are more than a rational, objective creature. The antique mirror that the woman finds in this poem, the antique mirror, that is the non-rational way of seeing. Antique. Antique mirror means way, goes way back, way back. Ancient antique mirror. Mirror, you know. The non-rational way of seeing. And when he says, she will no longer ignore her own head, it means now she trusts her true nature. So when we practice with trust, the idea of what's in my own best interest has a new meaning. It is no longer self-oriented. The my in it dissolves. It's no longer my best interest. Then the feeling we have is what's in best interest. Everybody's best interest, not just my best interest. So we drop off the my as we continue our practice. And the encouragement that arises is all the discipline we need to continue. Then we have a new appreciation of ourself and of our life. So, best interest includes everyone, includes all others. And our own individual self disappears. Does anyone have a question? Yes, Ken.
I think this could also happen to somebody who's been doing this for a number of years. Just somebody comes newly to practice. I know myself, the last couple of years I've been saying I've been in transition, but in truth, a lot of the stable things of my life that I had known for 20 or 30 years were gone. And I wasn't quite sure what to stand on. And instead, in some ways, I started telling myself, I need to get my discipline in on my practice. And in the same words you used. But I'm kind of realizing when you talk about what's in it for me, I maybe want to rephrase it, if I need to figure out what's real for me and what isn't, or where I need to stand, or what direction I need to go. And there was this need of not trusting me and wondering how I can figure out what's going to come in the future. No, I'm going to figure that out. So I really appreciate your talk tonight. It was... very heartfelt.
Thank you. Oh, Scott, excuse me.
Les, what about it when a cloud covers the moon?
Clouds are not permanent. Clouds come and go. And once we glimpse the moon, then we're not concerned when a cloud covers it up temporarily. Yes, Bonnie.
I don't really have a question, but there's a part that really struck me, which is you said when we don't trust other people, we're really not trusting ourselves. And I find this in my life to be true. Whenever I feel like, oh, I just can't stand to see that person right now, I realize it's because I don't trust that I can handle it at the time, like that I'm going to respond appropriately or set healthy boundaries or be able to say no if I need to. And so the more I'm grounded and stable, the more I feel like people can be however they are and I'll be able to do what's right. So that part really connected with me.
Yes, Umar.
Peter, question came to my mind when you were during your lecture, which is, what comes after silence?
When it comes to silence, there is no before and after. Oh, yes, please.
Question, just... thinking about best interest, I've been assuming that this might be about grasping, especially when we're talking about affluence, about desire, fulfillment of desire. But I guess I'm just assuming that probably the same truth would be there when we're concerned with fear or danger or risk to the self or one's condition.
When you sit quietly with awareness, where does the fear go? Yes, Yashree.
I really enjoyed the talk. And I've often thought a lot about this idea of ready mind. And it seems like it's a natural state. Is it a natural state? So if I don't, is it a natural state is my question, then... And I guess it's coming to me that if that is the case, then you really can't How do you help others then, if it comes from within, as your own natural state? So then you have to kind of accept that that is in everybody. They all have this natural state. And so there's really not much then you can do. Is that correct?
Did you mean not much you can do to help other people?
In the practice.
So there are ways that people help each other in everyday life, keep lending a hand with this and that. But in the in the Buddhist spirit, in the Buddhist understanding, the way we help each other is by being a bodhisattva. And in early Buddhism, when they talk about the three bodies of Buddha, there is the Sambhogakaya Buddha, the Buddha who appears in the world to save people. But it's more than just giving a hand. It's being Buddha. It's hard for us to imagine helping in that way, because we're so used to helping in a very practical, actionable way. But when you look at the teachers of the past in all disciplines, all religions, all practices, the ones that are respected the most and are revered the most are the ones that just express their true nature, their bodhisattva nature. Without any goal, without any idea of fixing something, just being a being natural. So when we have a caring nature, like the story of Buddha, he looked at the world and he saw all the suffering and he said, it's up to me. It's up to me. I'm going to figure this out. And he did all his ascetic practices. That's amazing. It's up to me. So it's up to us, up to each of us, to just express the practice as best we can, whenever we can. And in the long run, that's the best way of helping. Thank you. And welcome back. Welcome back. Oh, yes, please.
Years ago, I came here on your question and realized this happens occasionally in my life. I didn't know why somebody was so attractive to me. And what came to me was you may not recognize the importance you have on other people. So I know for you and me, it's more than what you say, it's that you are here sitting, you help me.
I just remember my own, I remember Suzuki Roshi, who we talk about a lot. And we talk about him a lot because when you meet him and you're with him, his life gave evidence that it's possible. Wow. Impossible for that human being. Oh, maybe possible for me too, to live authentically. Oh, and that's encouraging, and start to make an effort. Oh, yes, Carolina.
Something you taught me that has been very important to me. You defined, if somebody asked you, how do you develop self-discipline? And you said, stop feeling sorry for yourself.
Well, that sounds like boot camp.